young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street.
Eric Tyson with us. He is the author of Personal Finance in Your 20s for Dummies. He's an internationally acclaimed and best-selling personal finance book author. He's a syndicated columnist and a speaker, worked with and taught people from all financial situations, so he knows what the boots are on the ground of real finance is. And after toiling away for a number of years as a management consultant for Fortune 500 financial firms, He took his inside knowledge of the banking, the investment, the insurance industries, and committed himself to making personal finance management accessible to all. And let's say, Eric, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Thank you so much for being here. You know, I wished, and I can't go back, it's too many years, that I would have had your book when I was in the 12th grade. And I imagine it would have saved me probably over the years, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I wonder how many kids get out on the street and they say, oh, it's plastic, it's not money. And they get into it, have no idea what they're dealing with, and all of a sudden they are in deep trouble. So what do we look at when we first start to deal with people to make them understand that there's a different definition of money than you think there is?
Well, you know, you hit one of the big nails on the head there in that, you know, when you get out of school and you have your first job and you're earning income, you know, one of the first things you should do is get in the habit of living within your means and saving some money on a regular basis. And a big impediment to doing that, of course, is spending more than you earn and racking up consumer debt, like on credit cards, or, you know, you go out and you buy a car and before you know it, you end up leaving the auto dealership having spent more in a car than you should have because you took out an auto loan or you're doing a costly lease. So, you know, how you spend your money, how you manage a budget, and setting up a regular savings program, ideally in some sort of a tax-advantaged account, in other words, an account that's going to give you some tax benefits from saving in it, those are some of the basic important principles that younger people especially should focus on managing.
You know what they really should have, Eric, and I really believe in my heart of hearts, classes on this. You know, maybe not necessarily in high school, but when they start to get into college, something that says, this is what money is, this is how you define it, this is what can happen to you, here are the consequences. If overspend is one thing, but if you don't know what you're doing, and it's not so much what they don't know, it's what they don't know, why I think your book is critical.
Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree with that. Actually, middle school or high school years actually I think are a good time to teach these concepts. And actually, increasing numbers, not a lot, but increasing numbers of high schools are offering elective courses that are either focus on personal finance or, you know, deal with economics, which is more tangential to the topic. But, you know, it's a good time to learn it because, yeah, when you get out in the real world, you're going to have money passing through your hands, you know, during the decades of your adult working life. And, you know, money doesn't come with directions. And you know, most people don't get the stuff growing up. And most families, you know, moms and dads are busy doing other things. And they themselves may not be that financially literate. So, you know, if you're lucky, you grow up in a house where your parents understand all this stuff and they teach you about it. But, you know, more often than not, you're going to have to pick it up on your own.
Sure, it's not going to happen for the most part immediately. And a lot of it is when they get knocked down and have to learn the lesson and then they have to struggle to get back up again. One of the things that I know that you work with, and it starts out, rent smart. You know, get somebody that's going to go out on their own for the first time. They're 19, 21, 22, 23 years old, somewhere in that age range. And are they going to go out their own? Now they're letting mom and dad know that they're adults now and they can handle things, and they get out there and all of a sudden you got to pay for rent. You got to do all of these things. What do you do now? How did they get rent smart?
Well, you know, yeah, most folks in their 20s are going to be renting for a number of years, and renting is not necessarily a bad thing. I think in the past, you know, before we had this, you know, significant slide in the real estate market, there was kind of a stigma associated with renting, and, you know, you're throwing your money away and flushing it down the toilet. And I never agreed with that. And, you know, despite, you know, I do believe that owning a home during most of your adult life should be financially rewarding. But, you know, in your 20s, when you don't have a lot of financial stability, maybe you don't have a lot of employment stability, you may be going back to school or doing other things, you know, renting is a reasonable thing to do. And one of the key things there is to, you know, if you can have, some roommates, you're probably going to have a much more economical situation than if you want to live on your own or live in the most expensive part of, your favorite city. So you certainly want to live someplace safe, and you certainly want to live someplace that is reasonably convenient to your job, but that doesn't mean you have to spend a fortune. And I know when in my 20s, I was able to, you know, save a lot more of my income and live within my means by, you know, typically having, you know, 2, 3, 4 roommates. So if you can rent a multi-unit apartment, for example, you're gonna find that you get a lot more for your money than if you try to rent a place by yourself.
And interestingly enough, when it goes beyond that, if you really sit a kid down, you probably scare them and they'll never leave home again. When you talk about you have to have a place to stay, so you're gonna have to have money for rent. Now all of a sudden you're going to make money. If you've got a job, you're going to have to pay taxes. And now you've got to go out and spend money on food. I mean, the list goes on. That's scary. That would be scary to a lot of kids if they realize this is what they're facing.
Right. Well, and that's where, you know, if, you know, for kids who haven't gotten kind of real world education from their parents, when they're around their own, they may not realize all the, you know, the individual expenses, some of which you just mentioned, you know, or maybe they had some concept, yeah, mom and dad go out and buy food, but, you know, they don't know how much, you know, they're going to spend on food on a typical month. So, you know, that's why it is useful to, you know, look at your paycheck, look how much is being taken out in taxes, and then start to work up some numbers and say, okay, well, after I, you know, my take-home pay, I'm going to be able to have this much left over. And then figure out, you know, how much are you going to be spending on rent? How much are you going to be spending on your car? You know, food. You're probably going to want to, you know, have an entertainment budget. You know, you want to take a vacation once or twice a year. You know, and that's where you really have to factor all that in. And what I find happens is younger people who don't do that and just get out and want to spend like, you know, they're big income earners. Those are exactly the kinds of people, if they have plastic in their wallet, run up big debts on their credit card and develop those bad habits.
You know, one of the things that you do talk about, and I think it's something that we have to bring up, and you mentioned it a moment ago, but food, it's a big part of the expenditure, because you can do a lot of things. If you had to, you could live in a tent, but you have to eat. And then to budget for that, to be able to say, this is what I'm going to spend smart. And spending smart is not in a lot of their heads.
Right. And, the thing with food is that, when you're growing up, you know, most of the time there's other people preparing meals for you, you know, mom and dad, you know, you go to school, you go to the cafeteria, you know, when you're on your own, guess what? You're going to have to cook for yourself. Eating out is going to be a costly thing to do. It's an expensive luxury that most people in their 20s certainly can't afford to do on a regular basis. So if you don't know how to cook, learn that skill. You know, first of all, it's fun to do. And secondly, you'll save yourself a lot of money and hassle over the years if you can learn to prepare some basic meals.
You see, I'm old school. I come from way back there, and in the rules that we live by, where it doesn't matter how you feel as long as you're looking good. Now, a lot of the kids have that same rule that's moved forward. You get out on your own. You're 20 something. Now you've got to be up to snuff with what everybody else is wearing. Where do you budget that and still stay up with the peer group?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a difficult thing. Now, if you can afford, you know, the designer clothes and it fits within your budget, I mean, who am I to tell you how to spend your money? But that's the question. You have to, That's the issue. You got to look at your monthly budget, figure out how much you can spend on things. And you know what? Maybe, you know, there are, you know, take clothing as an example. There are some expensive types of clothes you want to get. You know, there's stores that sell things on consignment, used clothing stores. So, you know, maybe you can get some of your favorite designer brand clothing, but you don't buy it new. You buy it secondhand. As long as it's in good condition, no one's going to know except you. And, you know, you got to find ways to be thrifty and still accomplish what you're hoping to accomplish. But, I tell people, look, don't get hung up on the name brands and, you know, at the end of the day, it's not going to matter, you know. So if you're hanging with a crowd where that's going to make or break your relationship with those people, then I would say, you know, you might want to take a harder look at who you're hanging out with.
No, absolutely. No question about it. I think one of the big problems that we would have today, I'm listening very close to you, Eric, and what I'm hearing is strategic thinking. And it's not really taught in the schools anymore. You know, we are so technologically oriented that we don't really have to think out what it is. You hit a button, you get an answer. But this is asking them, and which we should, and I have to say we because I'm part of the culture and the society, but we should be able to ask them to take a look at it and think a little differently than they have normally been taught to think. And that is going to be hard for a lot of these kids.
It is, especially when so many of the messages that kids get today, they're bombarded with advertising 24/7. You know, and this has gotten worse rather than better because of all these, you know, technological devices and gadgets and communication methods, you know, from Twitter to Facebook. And, you know, let's face it, at the end of the day, most of these things are being utilized by companies and product and service purveyors who are trying to pitch what they're selling. And look, capitalism is a terrific economic system. It provides a, you know, terrific economic bounty to our country and others, but, you know, there's definite downsides, and one of the downsides is that you're just constantly bombarded with advertising. So I think it's important for young people to, you know, learn some lessons to counterbalance that. Hopefully their parents can pass some of that on. Hopefully their teachers can pass some of that on. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you look in the mirror, and that's the person who's responsible for handling your money. And, you know, so that's why my book, you know, Personal Finance in Your 20s for Dummies, is really a helpful resource for people. You know, take some responsibility, take the time and effort, you know, read my book, books like it, and educate yourself so that, you know, that way you've got no excuses for not doing it the right way.
Now, by the way, the 20-somethings, you know, investing in electronic gadgets, is that something that they should be doing because of the expedience of things, or should they back off?
Well, you really have to be careful. I mean, so many of these devices, you know, before you know, you get a cell phone and think, well, gee, you know, a cell phone's a reasonable communication device, but there's so many bells and whistles and services and downloads that you can get on it. And before you know it, you know, rather than spending $30 a month on a cell phone, you know, I see, you know, young people with $200-$400 monthly tabs on their cell phones. So, you know, I'm not anti-technology, but I'm anti-wasting money. And you know, I do encourage people to really think long and hard about how they're spending their money on technology and resist the temptation to get more and more gadgets and more bells and whistles on those gadgets, because most of the time you don't really need it.
And, you know, and another thing that the kids just do not think about, if you're out on your own, how about health insurance and how about the, you know, health care, et cetera? They're going to go out, they're going to get hurt, they're going to get bruised. What do they know as far as going out and getting their own? You know, mom's always done it for me. Dad's always done it for me. And all of a sudden you're on your own. And if you get old enough, they don't carry it on their policies. What do you do? How do you get them to address it?
Yeah, well, it is important to have it. You know, a lot of young people think, oh, you know, I'm young and I'm healthy and, you know, nothing, you know, I don't need to worry about it. And to a certain extent, there's some truth to that. But, you know, we don't know when, you know, we're going to be struck by a major illness or be in a, you know, accident. So you really do have to have, you know, catastrophic so-called major medical coverage. What you can do to keep the cost of health insurance down is to take a high deductible, the deductible being the amount out of pocket you have to pay if you have a claim. That will dramatically reduce the premium that you're having to pay for the insurance, but that way if you do end up having you know, some catastrophic medical expenses, the vast majority of those will be covered. Another thing you can do you know, there are health savings accounts out there. They're like retirement accounts. You can put money away. You get an immediate tax break on the contribution. But the money that's in that account then you can use for future health care expenses. So the advantage being that you get some tax benefit from doing it. So it's another thing to be aware of. You know, some people in their 20s may not be in a financial position to take advantage of that right away, but it's just something to be knowledgeable about.
You know, it's a whole different world out there. You know, when I was 20 years old, it was a lot of years ago, and the rules, the ground rules were exactly the same, with the exception of the costs weren't as large as they were today. We also didn't make as much money as you can possibly make today. Because sitting down and plotting your own financial future if you're 20-something has got to be a very hard deal. And I'm going to use the word again. It's got to be very scary if you haven't been exposed to it before. And mom and dad, they don't know. And it's called, how do you really get someone, and I've asked it in different ways, but to sit down and say, take a look at your life. Because if you don't, life's going to be miserable.
Oh, and I agree with that. I mean, there is a lot at stake. And look, I mean, this stuff is kind of intimidating. It's overwhelming. It's a field where there's a lot of jargon. You know, the world is more complex today than it was years ago. You know, wasn't that many generations ago where, you know, you got out of school, you took a job with a big company, they put money away on your behalf for your future retirement and a pension plan, and you didn't even have to think about really investing money from your job. Now, in most cases, you've got a 401k plan where, you know, you've got to make a decision how much you want to have deducted from your paycheck. You've got to make a decision how that money is going to be invested. You've got to select the investments and decide how to manage that over time. And that's just one of a multitude of decisions that you have to make. You know, insurance is another one. You know, you get a car, you got to buy auto insurance. Well, there are a lot of companies that sell auto insurance. There's a lot of options on a typical auto insurance policy. So, you know, if you weren't exposed to this stuff growing up, especially in detail, you know, it can be overwhelming and stressful. And,
oh, no question.
But, you know, the important thing to remember is that you can master it and just take it one step at a time.
A lot of aspirins and Prozac will get you through it. There's no question. let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time. Eric Tyson, a website we can find you at.
Yeah, erictyson.com, Eric with a C, TYSON.com. You know, that is information on all my books. There's, you know, there's some free articles up there. There's also a premium service for people who want to, keep up with what's going on in the investment world, low-cost premium service, $18 a year. You know, again, I say to people, you know, keep educating yourself. Take an interest in this area, because if you don't take an interest in your 20s, you know, when you hit middle age or your later years, you're going to regret not having made that investment in your younger years.
Well, I hear you loud and clear. Hey, Eric Tyson, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the program, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm
parapet. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser Art After Dark. Dr. Sam Jang with us, coming up.
And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and
London. Dr. Sam Jang with us. He is the author of the epic novel Genghis Khan, the World Conqueror. It was written after 8 years of intensive research. And during those 8 years, he made 7 or 8 trips to Mongolia, to Russia, to China and related countries. He had interviewed numerous people in those countries and had read hundreds of articles and rare books in the libraries of Mongolia and beyond. And he testifies that his book, Genghis Khan, the World Conqueror, was written in the term of historical novel, and yet 90% of its contents are based on the sensible, true story. He also believes that his book covers many facts which the majority of past historians have failed to see due to their lack of understanding of this unique cultural, social, political, historical, and geometrical background of the people of Genghis Khan's era. And let us say, Sam, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I've heard so many different stories about Genghis Khan, and what we've heard and what truly is, from what I understand, Sam, is completely different. Genghis Khan was not, you know, the killer conqueror that he was portrayed to be in the movies. There was another side, another dimension of him, wasn't there?
Yeah, I wanted to tell the other people or tell the world that Genghis Khan was the turning point of, you know, the world history in the positive direction, because before emergence of Genghis Khan and his Mongol Empire, the world, you know, East and West couldn't communicate. And then, but after emergence of his Mongol Empire, it was possible to communicate and exchange the idea, and then after all, that spurred, you know, speed of human civilization. That's what I believe.
Now, by the way, he was called many, many names, you know, destroyers of civilization, warmonger, and so on and so forth. But if you really take a look at this man, did he not build countries? Was he not a bridge between culture to culture to culture? Are there things that we don't know about this man that he actually did that would change our minds if we had to describe him today?
You know, basically, Genghis Khan is not known very well in the American continent in here. But Europe and Asia, you know, they know him very well, because that's the place that the Genghis Khan ruled and his Mongol Empire ruled. You know, actually, he was, after all, he was a builder of a new world rather than destroyer. Of course, you know, at the beginning, he was a destroyer. But after all, you know, he was a builder of a new world, and a new world was a turning point of a human, you know, the world history. And then, but into the positive direction, and that's the point I want to tell the people, that he is, after all, benefactor rather than destroyer. And then, you know, I cannot tell everything in 10, 15 minutes, you know, no. But for example, you know, American discovery of American continent is related with the Mongol Empire, because everybody knows that Columbus was the one who discovered American continent and introduced to the Europeans. But, you know, Columbus was influenced by Marco Polo. It's not many people knows about that. And then Marco Polo was the one who opened the gate between East and West. And okay, then...
So let me hold you up for a minute, because we've heard so much Columbus discovered the American continent, but what about Amerigo Vespucci? Wasn't he there before? Didn't he get there before Columbus? And wasn't he one of the first to discover? From what I understand, and please stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a historian, but Columbus hit South America, Vespucci hit the mainland here.
Actually, you know, at the time, European continent was very much crowded and not much natural sources. So that's why they tried to find a route to some place with abundant sources. And that's the main purpose of Columbus, you know, is a sailing. And then accidentally at the time, the India was the part of is the Mongol Empire. Actually, the founder of Mughal Empire, you know, was the descendant of Genghis Khan, and then the his Mughal Empire. Mughal means that is a Mongol, is a pronunciation of a Mongol, is a Mughal. Is a Mughal Empire was ruling the Indian continent, India, for 400 years. And then at that time, Columbus was, you know, was heading for the India. And then the but everybody knows accidentally he discovered the American continent. But originally he set sail for the India. And then he tried to find a sea route to the, you know, more, you know, to find more sources like that. And then after all, you know, discovery of American continent is like, you know, very, very beneficial to other part of the world. For example, you know, it's at that time the European, like I said, you know, originally the, you know, the many materials, you know, in unique in American continent and here is like it's potatoes and then, you know, tobaccos and all the, you know, all kinds of you know, the abundant natural sources is went into the Europe and other part of the world, and that eventually saved the other part of the world. And then that is the kind of the emergence of a Mongol Empire, and the Mongol Empire united the, you know, two, you know, continent, the European continent, the Asian continent. And then after that, world, you know, history is going into some kind of direction, but I would say it's a positive direction.
Now, by the way, Sam, now this is directly from your press release, because I think this makes all the sense in the world, that the greatest of the Mughal Empire is represented in their success at opening trade between the East and the West. And the most meaningful and influential items in human civilization, we're talking about paper, gunpowder, the compass, had all been transferred from the East all the way to the West. So right. he really opened the door. He was the bridge between all of that.
Yeah, that's correct. It's the gunpowder, papers, and compasses, you know, all those very important, you know, invention for the civilization was transferred from the East to the West, and from the West to the East, you know, some kind of numeric systems, you know, it's like astrology or some kind of, you know, some manufacturing of some glasses and some, you know, those, you know, came to the, you know, East. And then, so they could freely exchange the ideas, and that eventually, you know, spurred, you know, the world civilization. That's what I think.
Yeah, but and we haven't tied Marco Polo, you know, the first getting to Beijing, that we didn't tie that in, because that was the normal person in thinking about it was a great turning point in Western history, because it was Kublai Khan. It was right during his time. So all of these things were going on at the same time, but we hear the stories, we separate them, and we never get to put them together.
It's, you know, it's like at that time, the Mongol Empire, actually, it was ruled by four different khanates. It's, there's a Golden Horde was the covering the Russia and Eastern Europe, and then the Ilkhanate was governing the Persian Empire. And then there's another one in governing the Chagatai Khanate. It was the ruling the Central Asian area, and then the Kublai Khan was ruling the Chinese, you know, the actually China is Chinese, yeah, continent. You know, actually, but the all Khanates is basically is one nation under one ruler and one nation. So it's a, you know, trade between East and West was very much easier than, you know, before. And, you know, is before, you know, emergence of Mongol Empire, you know, traveling from in the Italy to the Beijing was impossible.
No, by the way, in today's world, you know, it sounds like with the research that you've done and what you put to pen, we're in a situation whereby we didn't realize what he had, what kind of an impact he had on how we live our lives today.
I would say we can learn from history, especially for the leadership. And I'm talking about the leadership. Leadership as for the individual basis, like how you can motivate others, how you can win friends, you know, something like that. But it's a leadership for the large group of people, like a nation or even whole world. And then they could successfully rule the world for many years, many part more than 100 years. And in the Golden World lasted almost 300 years. And then when they could rule the world in a very successful way, there's something in it. And then we could learn from history how, you know, lead the world in very in a successful way. That's the one thing. And then the readers of my book, can benefit. For example, myself, I can learn from him. What you are learning from him? It's he was a self-conqueror. He conquered himself first before he conquered the world. And then, the readers will get an idea. It's how you can manage the world, how you can, self-help, type of story, something like that. There's a lot of things you can learn from that story, I would say like that. So there's something you can learn, when you invest, I know that it's readers, to read that book, the two-volume book is like that. They have to invest time and money, but eventually I got a review from many actual readers. They say this is the story they enjoyed very much. At the same time, they learned many things.
Now, by the way, I think the operative thing that you said here was he conquered himself before he went out and conquered the world. And many people today, even those who are in governmental power in the different countries, etc., if you don't conquer yourself, you're going to have different weaknesses and you're not going to stay focused. And if you watch the personality of a leader, wherever they are, what you'll see is that trickle down to the basic population. And I think it was brilliant by conquering himself. He conquered the world. Had he not conquered himself, he could have been spread out. A great example of that would have been Hitler. Hitler did not conquer himself. He stopped his armies. He stopped his generals. He did so many things at one time that that he actually was the one who defeated himself. Had he been smart, everything might have turned out differently. He didn't conquer himself, so therefore he couldn't conquer the world. And I think it was brilliant in that thinking and that many years ago of what you would have to do to stay focused on the goal.
Right. When you compare the conquerors, Genghis Khan was the only one who fulfilled his dream and then his destiny or his, he got what he wanted other than the others, actually all the other, the conquerors, you named it as, for example, Hitler, and then they couldn't get what they wanted. Actually, they are failures. And then their empire didn't last long, as Hitler lasted only 3 years. It's like that. So he was the, when you review all the history, he was the only successful conqueror. And then he got the only title, the world conqueror. And then that's what I say.
Yeah, and realistically, we would have to redefine the definition of conqueror. Because if we hear it today, conqueror means somebody who's going to go out there and destroy countries and bring the world into the one place where they dictate. That's not what a conqueror was in those days. And I really believe based on the definitions we have of something today and based on the definitions of what was in yesteryear, you got a completely different story. And I think the stories about Genghis Khan were created years after he was gone. And it was based on how people saw history, how people define history and all those historical events. And it got twisted by the time it was all over with.
Yeah, that's the point. I put that down in my preface of my book. You know, he should not be, measured by modern standard, I would say. The time has been changed. It was the 13th century. It was in the 13th century. And then, now it's 24th century. We cannot, measure him by 24th century standard. No. But what I'm trying to tell other people is eventually his original motivation is many different historians say different way. But after all, his Mongol, the world has been changed after emergence of Mongol Empire. It's many different ways. And then I would say it's a positive direction. He was a turning point of world history. That's the point, But originally, what I believe is he had a dream. He had a vision, some kind of vision, and then many people just simply tell describe him as a killer or some destroyer. But eventually, that's not true. It's many people say he killed too many people, but at the time the population of people of Genghis Khan was presumed to be about 2 million, and 2 million people conquered 100 times or 200-300 times a bigger population. In that situation, he didn't have many choice. His tactic was, very, very strict. And without his tactic, the conquering all the other part of the world was impossible. But he saved all the people who surrendered, and at the same time, who gave the helping hand, and then who followed his policies and everything, and he saved them, and he never killed anybody from those people. The people he removed was the somebody who is a real enemy, something like that. So he was brilliant soldier. That's what I describe him, based on his actual tactic. Not simply is a killer or a destroyer. No, I don't think so. No.
Yeah, Sam, we're starting to run out of time now. Let me ask you this: a website that we can find you and also find the book.
Our website is my website is www.worldkhan.com. worldkhan.com, and you'll get much idea from there. And the title of the book is the Genghis Khan, the World Conqueror. There's many other books similar titles. So the Genghis Khan, the World Conqueror, Volume 1 and Volume 2, and then the you can find the author's name is Sam DeJong, or the publishing company name is New Horizon Books. It's like that.
Wonderful. Hey, Sam DeJong, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I appreciate the time you spent with us. Good
thank
night.
Thank you so much. All right. The only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. Yeah.
are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Gaza, Jamaica, Bombay.
And welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back with us, Susan Marshall, author, speaker, president of Executive Advisor LLC. It's an independent consulting firm founded in 1997, specializing in leadership development and executive effectiveness. Her book is How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. And let us say, Susan, welcome back.
Hi, Michael Ray.
Yeah, I want to make a comment, okay? Now, by the way, Radio Susie, listen to this very closely, okay? I'm waiting to listen to this interview, and if it's not your best, be careful on your way home.
Is that a trap?
It was intimidating, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
That was the segue into the subject.
I love it. You know what? And as we think about what is going on all around us right now, we're heading into political silly season. Oh, wait a minute. Have we ever been away from it?
But no.
The notion of intimidation is really something that I find to be quite fascinating. There are some people who are very, very skilled at it. There are other people who are just terrible hacks.
Yeah.
And yet it seems to be becoming part of our culture.
Yeah. By the way, I completely agree with that. So let's start with a basis and let's say, what is intimidation? Let's create a foundation and then let's work our way up from there.
Super. So when we talk about intimidation...
Let me ask you first, before we get started, did I scare you at all? Did I?
No.
Are
you disappointed in that?
Yeah. I thought it was going to be something.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to have to go back and read how to do it again. Okay, go ahead.
That made me scared. Well, and you know what? What a wonderful, really wonderful stepping stone into what is intimidation. And what we're talking about here is an effort on the part of an individual to make someone timid or afraid, or using threats of violence to force or deter. So when someone is intimidating another person, they are seeking to stop that person by making them afraid or sort of indirectly threatening violence. And if you think about that as an equation, we've got the intimidator or the attempting intimidator, and then we've got the intimidatee. And in order for intimidation to be successful, the intimidatee has to play. So the person being intimidated has to feel somewhere afraid, timid, or if he or she were to take the next step forward in whatever their plan is, there may be retribution.
And okay, so if you keep if you keep it up, we know where your dog is.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
I find you on Google Maps. Oh yeah.
Okay, I said gotcha. Okay, I'm sorry, but it's true, and they have an impact on you. They're always around. It comes from the job. It comes from a relationship. It comes from the person on the street. There's something that we have learned in this country, well, all over the world, actually,
that if
you want something, intimidate somebody, scare them.
That's right.
Look at what's going on politically today. Look what's going on in the newspapers, the radio, television. It's fear, intimidation, and it works.
It does work, and in fact, I was talking with a group at Mount Mary College today. They have a new leadership program that they run every summer, and it's designed for women who want a role in public policy and take it one step further, who are really very interested in exploring the possibility of running for political office. And so this topic of conversation today was very timely and is absolutely essential for them to understand if they are going to enter that arena, because it has become part of our culture. And this notion of treating each other with any sense of genteelness or respect or just common courtesy is sort of bygone. And so while we might lament that, while we might say, gosh, that's too bad, this is going nowhere good, the fact is it's reality today. And
by
so
the way, if you want to talk about politics, let me just throw this out. Let's use Sarah Palin as an example. Now, she's making her decision whether she's going to run or she's not going to run. And I would venture to guess what's going on in her mind is, I want to run, I want to do it, but if I do it, what is that? How is that going to impact and affect my family? Because the moment she throws her hat in the ring, she's going to be opened up to the garbage that's going to come out after her. So it's a very interesting thing. So you're right. You got to be tough enough to do this. Otherwise, you're going to get eaten alive.
Well, and the first rule of intimidation is expect it. Expect it. It amazes me when I see men and women equally step up to state a point of view or take a position or introduce a new, somewhat controversial idea and deer in the headlights when they get blowback. So first rule of intimidation is expect it. I think Sarah Palin is a very interesting case study because she was clearly intimidated 2 years ago by 3 years ago by Katie Couric.
Yeah.
I mean, that will be forever her lasting Achilles heel and how she just did not do well. But what I find fascinating about Sarah Palin is she has learned from that. And frankly, I would be surprised if she decided to run. She's having a ball.
Oh, sure.
Saying what she believes, being absolutely unaccountable in a political sense for what she's saying because she hasn't declared. She's making a ton of money. She's gaining, friends and supporters all across the country. Why would she throw that into the arena of serious political candidacy and have to deal with all of the stuff that she knows is coming? She's got it coming anyway.
I'll
be interested to see this. But from her standpoint, she has learned to deal with intimidation, and it's kind of interesting to watch what she's done.
But look what happened to Trump. It's very interesting.
He was
running for president, and then all of a sudden he got this. And I can't understand why he stepped down a $200 million offer to stay with his TV program. But it's true. It's called value. We have gotten into it. It's always been bad. Susan, there's no question about it. It's always been bad. But in the last couple, 3 years, it has been horrible. You step up there, they're going to find everything they can possibly find out about you, and you have to be very careful. And this is why I do not understand why we will not mention his name, because you can see him all over television, who sent a picture of himself in his underwear over Twitter.
Good Lord.
How could
but
you
he didn't.
Do that?
Oh, no. His account was hacked. He didn't really do it. And then said, well, I can't really be certain whether that's me or not. Stop talking.
We're going to go back to the John quote. These are the T-shirts we're going to sell, and we're going to make lots of money. John Wayne's famous quote, life is tough, but it's worse when you're stupid.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
And when you're stupid and you are able to be intimidated, go home. Stay home on the porch. Don't enter the arena because you're going to get killed.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to this group of women that we were talking with today, and they ranged in age from 20-somethings college students probably to mid-60s, women who are very interested in learning about public policy and actually the topic that they're working with all week long with help from some folks from the White House is human trafficking, which, as you can imagine, from an intimidation standpoint, is just rich with material and the history of girls being, sold into prostitution and all of that kind of thing back in the Civil War days is really very interesting to listen to that and to understand how girls are not taught to have value, self-value, and how some of those seeds of doubt stay with women over many, 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 many generations. And so we talked about simple things, the words that derail women, and even strong women who have, points of view, have done their homework, they know what they're talking about. And we got simple things like, why did you say that? after a woman has spoken, when somebody comes back and says, why did you say that? That's a derailer. Women will think, well, did I say it wrong? What do you mean? Why did I say that? So that was a very powerful one. One of the women said, one of the things that derails her absolutely instantly is when somebody says, you're a nag. If she says the same thing two or three times, you're a nag. Absolutely sends her over the edge.
But what
you are overreacting.
What great power there is in the words. You want me to control you? You're a nag.
Yeah.
Why did you say that?
Yeah.
See, if I know ahead of time, I've got you. You're going to be completely defenseless against me.
Yes. Oh, Susan, you're overreacting. Oh, that's a hot button for a lot of women. You're selfish. Ah, that goes right to the heart of a woman's socialization as a nurturer. What do you mean I'm selfish? You are judgmental. Well, you know, somebody says that. I hear the word judgmental, the word judgmental, and I think, thank goodness. Yes. We make judgments every day a billion times a day. I pour coffee in my coffee cup, not motor oil, right? And yet the word judgmental carries such a negative connotation that people can quickly and intentionally tip a woman over if that's something that she can't deal with. Here's one that came up that I thought was really interesting.
There's a message here, and we've talked about it time and time and time and time again, all right? And the message is this. That you're not talking, when I say you, I don't mean you, Susan, but you're not talking about me. You're talking about you. And when you get that, all of a sudden, all of these things kind of disappear and they go away.
Yes.
You don't get derailed.
Provided you do the homework before you step into an arena where you are going to present your point of view. Prepare, prepare, prepare. And you know this, and you teach this, and you work with people, you know, every day on this. But when I'm talking about prepare in the context of what are you going to do to counteract intimidation, not only be prepared with your point of view and have your research done and your facts done, understand who else is going to be involved in the conversation. What are their points of view? If you're going to be in a specific location that you've never been to before, a restaurant perhaps, a meeting room, a conference room, go there, get the feel of the room, get the layout. That's all part of the preparation so that nothing comes at you that you didn't expect or you've not experienced before and you get tipped over. So the preparation is absolutely essential, well, you know, to life, generally speaking. But then a couple of other things to counteract intimidation is to recognize the tactics, very much to your point. You're not telling me anything about me when you try to intimidate me. You're telling me about you. And so when I can recognize the tactics, when I'm aware of some of the words that are used, some of the phrases that are used, I can say, okay, here it is. I get it. I know what this is. I don't have to be afraid of it. Third, know your own hot buttons. What are the things that light you up like a Roman candle? I can remember 20, 30 years ago, actually, by now, I worked for a guy who I didn't particularly care for, but he said to me one day, because I was working for peanuts, and I was suggesting that there were other things that I could do for this organization to bump my pay, and he said to me, you know what, Susan? You're ambitious. And he spat the word at me like it was, you know, he couldn't wait to get it out of his mouth.
What a compliment.
I was horrified.
I know, but what a compliment.
Right.
Gotcha. I can see exactly what that would do to you.
Yeah. And so I had to sit with myself and say, okay, you know what? Ambition is a very, very good thing. It's essential to continuing to learn and grow. But it was not only the word, it was the tone of voice, it was the contempt with which he said it that really got me sideways. I thought about that for quite a long time.
Do you know why he said that to you?
Know your hot buttons.
Do you know why he said that to you? I'm serious. You intimidated him.
Yes.
And he had to bring it down to a level where he was stronger and more powerful. So what he did was he fought fire with fire, but you didn't know you were in the fight.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And what you just said, you intimidated him, that is a very, very awful thing to say to some women. You are intimidating. because their first reaction is, what do you mean? I'm not intimidating. I'm just me. No. So what we talked about today in that particular, with that phrase or that sentence, you are intimidating. The question that you need to ask back is, what is making you uncomfortable?
So you know what my response would have been? That if I would have been a woman, they would have said, you're intimidating. And I would have said, thank you. It's taken me an hour and a half to get dressed, to choose the clothes, the makeup, the rest of it, to look the way I want to look. So you'll look at me when I walk down the hallway. And thank you very much. You want my autograph.
That's the spirit. That's the spirit. Practice. Yes. But until you're ready to get there, an easy question to take it off of you, because women get so self-conscious. You are intimidating. I'm curious. What's making you uncomfortable? Oh, I didn't say that. You know, Larry said that. Well, what made Larry uncomfortable? Go ask Larry and come back. I mean, so get it off of you and get it back onto the person who's trying to give it to you, which is really, it really gets to be a lot of fun. And then there's sort of the granddaddy of all, right? The words that derail women. You are a witch with a B.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You're a bitch.
Yeah.
Women are still shocked when that's directed at them. We hear it all the time. Oh, she's a bitch. And they're shocked when it comes at them because, well, let me ask you, if you were to think, I know you would never, ever say it, but if you were to think of some woman, gosh, she's a bitch.
Yeah.
What would you mean by that word?
Not tolerable, the overbearing.
Yep. Mean-spirited.
Yeah.
Angry. Overbearing is probably constant, overly aggressive.
Yeah.
You know, just ugly.
Yeah.
And so I said, what if we were to take that word and make an acronym of it and then help you understand why you absolutely want to become a bitch? And they're all, of course, they're looking at me sideways like, okay, here we go. So in thinking about it, let's talk about a bitch as being someone who B, brings, I, information, T, to, C, change, H, hearts. So a bitch is someone who brings information to change hearts. We're not caring about changing minds because minds can be changed by the next most eloquent argument. But when you change hearts, you change lives.
Sure.
And when you think about these women who are investigating the opportunities the opportunities to go into public administration, public policy, politics, isn't their mission really to bring information to change hearts?
Today?
Heck yeah, I'm a bitch. Yeah. Proud of it.
Yeah.
And it was the kind of
and I'm cute,
complete
too.
Reversal of the sense of that word that really had them going, huh, well, maybe I can just embrace this.
Now, by the way, years ago, I did a segment on the show. It was probably 20, 25 years ago. I did a segment on the show. And it was called the Bitter Individual Telephone Hour. And I thought, I've got to complain. B-I-T-C-H-O.
Sounds like a gas.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, I did that for 6 months, 9 months, never said anything about what it meant. If you walked in the studio, you saw it up there because the B-I-T-C-H, you know. But that's really what it was. It was the Bitter Individual something Telephone Hour, and it was B-I-T-C-H. And if you
How
wanted to
bit,
go ahead and do it. But the key is nobody caught it. And I really believe even calling somebody that, it means that they've intimidated you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Rattled your cage.
Yeah. Yeah. And so
yet,
how do you get, you call them names.
To be introspective about that or to own that. Oh, self-responsibility? Come now.
Yeah.
Surely you jest.
I don't think so. Well, and I got it. Why be responsible for your actions? It's easier to blame somebody else.
And unfortunately, we have so-called leaders, not only here in the States, but literally globally, who are building their reputations and their careers on intimidation. They learn to intimidate. Some of them are very subtle about it. Some of them do it with a little smirk. Some of them are like Rahm Emanuel, right, who took his lessons from the Godfather. Give me a dead horse head in my bed. Okay, I get the message. So, but intimidation really, truly has become part of our culture. And that's unfortunate, particularly when, if we don't sort of pull it apart and take a look at really what is it we're talking about, how do I engage as one who may be intimidated, and then what do I do to prevent it? What do I do to manage it? Probably is a better way to look at it.
Yeah.
So prepare.
I agree. And, you know, there's another way to handle this also. They just came across the wire right now. These two tornadoes hit Springfield, Massachusetts, leaving lots of injuries and extensive damage. They got about 1,000 National Guard troops in there.
Right if you were now, in the middle,
now? Yeah, right now. Yeah.
Oh, my.
Just came across the wire. Yeah. If you were in that right now, how much would you be thinking of calling somebody a name? How much would you be thinking about intimidating somebody?
Yeah.
You'd want them at your back.
Right.
And there's where the problem is. It's conditions, situations, time and place that cause us to be and do and feel the way we feel. And I think it needs to be really, truly looked at. If you don't like yourself, leave everybody alone.
Yes. And, you know, you probably talk with many, 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 many psychologists to know that absolutely the opposite is what happens. You don't like yourself, you strike out. And this culture of envy that we have, right? If I don't like me, I'm going to find somebody that I think has it all together, and I'm going to chip and tear and do whatever I can to denigrate that person because I am desperately unhappy with me. And that's what people do. And without realizing, they're not hurting that person one iota.
No.
And they're just mired in their own, you know, self-contempt. But we can talk about it, and you know, everybody loves good conversation like this. It's very, very difficult to take oneself in hand, particularly when we live in a culture such as we live in, and say, you know what, this isn't working for me. I've got to change this. I want to be a bitch in the sense that I want to change hearts. I want to bring information. Now I can get busy working on something,
yeah,
rather than being upset or a target of intimidation. You know what?
I call that, mind is that to my dog all the time, you son of a whatever, and he says, finally, yeah. Recognition.
Yeah, there's says, that aspect of it as well.
Yeah, you've met my mother. I got it. No, but when we really come down to it, when we really, really come down to it, it's called, you don't have to have thick skin. It's called just a shift in the way that you think about yourself and the way that you deal with others. For the most part, when you've got somebody calling your names, doing what they do, it's got nothing to do with you. You don't buy into it. It has to do with them. Because if you leave, whoever takes your place, they're going to do the exact same thing to somebody else.
That's ever so correct.
Yeah.
And when you watch somebody in full-blown intimidation, I think I may have told this story another time when we talked about this. One of the chief of schools in one of the charter schools we're working with in Dallas is a big guy. He's an intimidating presence. He's got a big, booming voice. And he uses both his physical presence and his voice to intimidate people. It's almost like a bad habit. And what I noticed as I was watching this, and of course the principals and school leaders, particularly the women, are really genuinely scared of him, which infuriates him and causes him to say, I don't have the kind of leaders in these schools to help my kids be successful. Notice the I. What does that sound like? But he recognizes and admitted to me during one of our conversations that sometimes he intimidates on purpose just to see if anybody will stand up to him. And when they don't, he's infuriated. And so the question then becomes, do we work with someone who intimidates other on purpose? In my estimation, the answer there is perhaps, but not a lot. I think we've got to strengthen other people to recognize just exactly what you said. It's not about them. It's about the other person.
Yeah, and the other thing that I would like to, I wish I was there with you today when you were working with all of those women, because, you know, from a man's perspective.
Okay. Yes.
From a man's perspective, and the key is if you fall into it, if you are at a position whereby you're going to be affected by it, you've got to know it is not you, it is them. And you can say anything that you want to say, and for the most part, if you're saying, you know, they're doing this and they're doing that, and if you want to be damaged by it, quote unquote, then you're calling the shot. And if you go someplace else, you're going to find somebody else who's going to say the exact same thing to you to get you in the same place. So it's a reversible cause and effect.
Say that again. Reversible in what way?
It's a reversible cause and effect. Okay, we're starting to run out of time, but this way. If I have somebody trying to victimize me, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right, I'm calling for it in some way, shape, or form. Otherwise, it wouldn't be happening to me.
Yes.
So you've got the person that's the perpetrating the offense. It's not them. I mean, it's not you. It's them working it out on them. But at the same time, you need to prove yourself right about yourself. And where are you? You're in that place. So when you clear it, you're not in that place. It doesn't happen to you.
Yes.
Or something.
Well said.
Like, so yeah, it takes two to tango.
Yes.
Or something. We're running out of time, so I could talk to you all night. So let me ask you this. Website we can find you at?
www.executiveadvisorllc.com. Book
you know
is
what
there.
I like about,
lots of interesting readings there.
You know what I really like about doing the show with you? I get so intimidated when it's over with.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we share that, don't we?
You bet. All right, I got to go. Talk to you next week.
Thanks, Michael Ray.
And good
Bye-bye.
Night.
Whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. We're going to find out about cloud computing.
A love of my own.
Dermot Dougherty with us and Soon Justice are the founders of iSpaces. That's a virtual company that recently launched the first free multi-desktop cloud computer. And Dougherty's a former Irish League soccer player, software architect, and developer who has taught advanced web application at the University of California in Berkeley. Justice is the vice president of communications for Gryphon Development, which is an integral part of the team that launched the Bath and Body Works chain and the Victoria's Secret bath shop. So let's say Dermot and Soon, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Ray.
Thank you.
Am I saying that right? Is it Soon?
It's Sunny. It's
Sunny.
Actually much easier than it looks.
I knew that. I was just making sure that you had it down. Sunny,
thank you.
Sunny Justice, let me ask you first. Let me get into this. We're talking about something brand new, the cloud. Now, what are we talking about when we're revolutionizing computers? Because it changes so drastically every day. By the time you think you've got the most effective technological advances there are, 3 minutes later, somebody's made something better. So what are we dealing with that takes us that next step?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because the internet and the world of computing is really in a constant state of paradigm shifting. And the very interesting thing about what we see happening with the cloud right now is the cloud is almost making a full circle back to where the internet originally began. So the internet's about 35 years old right now, and its original vision was always that someday you would be able to access all of your information and data from any internet-connected device. But it's taken this 35 years to build the infrastructure, the high-speed internet, and to create the capabilities for the original vision of the internet to finally become a reality. So the cloud is really just a nickname for the internet or the World Wide Web, but it extends the internet itself now by actually allowing us to store and access data and applications through the internet itself. So yes, it is another paradigm shift, but I think it's where it's always been headed, and within 5 to 10 years, nobody will ever be able to remember that the cloud did not exist.
Dermot, let me ask you this. In lay language, what did Sonny just say?
He said that, well, basically the cloud is where computing is going to end up, and yes, we're going through a paradigm shift, but ultimately the promise of the internet was that you'd be able to access your data in the cloud, basically storing your data in the cloud, and basically that's where the computing is going to end up. So the cloud is basically the internet, but it's the internet delivering your applications and your data wherever you are.
Okay, so effectively, there is that connection. I'm sitting in my studio now in the office, and at the same time, I've got 4 or 5 computers around the house, and right now they're all connected, and so that works. But what you're saying, and stop me if I'm wrong, that you can say take that same application and you can make it universal. You can connect anywhere, anytime with anybody using a dimension of the internet that most people haven't realized was there yet. Am I close?
Yes, I think that's true. And here, let me give this analogy, which I think makes it really simple.
Thanks.
iSpace's technology, the cloud computer that we have developed, imagine that you're at work right now and you have your computer open and you're using iSpace's. We give you multiple desktops. So let's say in desktop one you're doing your work for the radio show, and desktop two your social networking, and desktop three your personal banking, whatever it might be. You might have 4 or 5 browser windows open in each of those spaces, and you might have 10 or 12 different tabs open in each of those browser windows.
Got
but
it.
Now it's time to go home. So you could close your computer at work, you could get in your car and drive home, and when you arrive home, you could, on any one of your computers at your house, log back into iSpaces, and everything that you had open in every one of your desktops and every browser and every tab will persistently present itself to you again. So you don't have to find all of the work you were doing, all of the bookmarks, reopen all of the tabs and the different applications you had. So it's not only about universal accessibility, but with iSpaces, we take that one step further and we offer what we call nonstop web, which is the capability of redelivering your information to you however you left it on any internet-connected device.
Okay, so
it's an amazing time saver.
Okay, so if I shut everything down right now, I have an emergency, I shut everything down right now, I've got 4 or 5 different screens open to me, and I leave and I go someplace else and I've got my laptop with me, I can zero right into what I left and I can start from scratch.
Correct, as long as you were using it through iSpaces.
No, I got that. No, that loud and clear.
Yeah, correct. So that's exactly it. It's like this is the alleluia moment. You're no longer tethered to a machine. And that is really always been the promise of the internet.
By the way, that's more than the hallelujah moment. That's better than bee pollination, I'm telling you.
We call it the Holy Grail.
I got it. No, this is good. Where did you guys develop this? How did you develop it?
Well, we were actually living down in Panama when the idea for iSpaces started to come to me and to us. And it was more or less we were moving from, we had a house in the countryside and I was doing a lot of development out there, and then we also had an apartment in the city that we would go to, and every now and again I would leave a file or two behind, and I would either have to rewrite the whole thing or just just get really frustrated and blame the internet or blame computers for not having evolved enough to give me my files wherever I was. So that was the first inspiration to basically be able to provide you with a system that allows you to have your files in the cloud so that no matter where you were, you could access them. And then at the same time, what happened that really spurred me on was Google announced the Google Chrome browser. And when they announced that, that was a big signal to me that this is where the web was going to go. Essentially, the web was going to become an operating system itself rather than just a browser, a back-forward browsing tool. It was the internet as an operating system.
Now, right now, we are looking at, I say, you know, we as a as the security part of the defense of our country here, we're looking at people invading the internet. We're looking at a sense of war breaking out when people can attack what we have via computers, hidden information, and so on and so forth. What do we do to make sure that it's safe? What do we do to make sure that once you create this kind of information, and you create the cloud and it's working that way, you can go back and forth and get anything you want anytime you want it. Where's the safety factor? How do I know that somebody's not going to hack me?
Well, you do have to build your systems to be ultimately secure. On the data center side, you install monitors to basically monitor all access to your machine. And ultimately, what iSpaces ourselves decided to do in the end was just to encrypt all data. That was the only way that we could guarantee 100% security for our data. So all information that's coming in and out of our servers encrypted, which means that even if somebody were able to hack some data out of iSpaces, they wouldn't have access to the information itself. So it's about encryption. It's about monitoring your server. And about being really diligent, you know, the security can be programmed, and it's very wise to consult with security experts.
By the way, I think and I'm not very technical. I mean, I know my way basically around a computer, but there's a point where I have to back off and say I'm lost here. But what I'm hearing so far, this is absolutely brilliant. And if this isn't the next step, the next wave to using what we have, the technology, then I don't know what is. But if you guys are the first on the street with it, quote unquote, I'd jump on this thing right now before anybody else got anything close to it.
Well, you know, that's really what we hope to inspire. You know, we hope to be a leader in this paradigm shift. And one of the amazing things that iSpaces offers that no one has yet accomplished besides Dermot is building an actual browser within a browser. So you can use iSpaces, you can enter through Windows or through Mac, and you can use Google Chrome or Firefox or Safari, whatever browser and whatever platform you use. And you simply go to iSpaces.com. But once you're in iSpaces, you're using our literal browser. You're no longer using Firefox or Safari. So that browser that lives within another browser is what's allowing the persistence to be able to redeliver your user interface to you. And people in Silicon Valley told Dermot it was impossible to build a browser within a browser, and he has proven that not to be true. And it's very lightweight and fast, typically more lightweight and fast than the browser that you're entering from. But the one other thing that I wanted to mention just about security as well, because people think of security and they think about getting hacked into their account. But interestingly enough, about 90% of security breaches happen from computers that are lost or stolen. And so one of the great advantages of using a system like iSpaces and moving your information into the cloud is that you have the option with iSpaces of saving your data solely in the cloud or leaving it on your machine as well as the cloud. And when you become confident enough to keep your information solely in the cloud, even if your machine is lost or stolen or if your hard drive crashes, you haven't lost anything. And so when people talk about security, that's really more of a feature that the cloud offers you as an advantage, because so many people do have their machines lost or stolen or their hard drive crashes. I'm sure most of us have experienced a digital colonic at some point in our life where we've lost everything. And that's not going to be the way in the future as things move into the cloud. If a kid starts using iSpaces in first grade, they'll be able to have access to anything they've ever done for the rest of their life. Because the interesting part is you won't even have to sync anymore. You'll be able to buy any device, any computer, any tablet, any smartphone as they evolve and they change for the rest of your life, but you'll still just go to iSpaces.com. And all of your information will be there just as you left it last time. So it simplifies things in so many ways while allowing you to continue to upgrade the type of devices that you like to use, which I'm sure will get simpler and simpler.
Sure.
Because the information is going to be stored on the Internet, not necessarily on your machine.
No, by the way, and to stay abreast, to try to stay up with today with everything that's going on is virtually impossible. But I think what you guys have hit is, yeah, it's like, quote unquote, it's the next Facebook when you're talking about social networking. But we're dealing with computers. I would love to talk to you guys in a year from now and see what would happen.
We would love to talk to you too. It's going to be a very interesting ride for the next year, that's for sure.
Oh, I bet it is. Okay, Sunny and Dermot, how do we find you? Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure, www.ispaces.com.
Now, by the way, can we sign up? Can we get the service there?
Yes. That's where you can register, and you'll get an email to activate, and then you simply log in and start using it. We're in our first release of our beta, and in about 6 weeks, we're going to be doing our second beta release, which is going to be offering a lot more file solution functionality, as well as increased browsing history and different enhancements to the cloud browser itself. So, you know, that we've launched on all platforms and being accessible from different browsers in itself is something that's not typically done in the industry. So people might have to understand that we're still in early days, but probably just about every 2 months we're going to be doing releases with new enhancements. So it's something to just start with. It's free. It doesn't cost anything. It's super simple to use. That was one of our absolute guidelines, is that everybody in the world had to be able to use it, not just really high-tech people or really, you know, high-level cloudies. It really was going to be for everyone. So that's the great advantage of it.
I think I'm going to get my head in the clouds.
I think we all are eventually. Yes, there's going to be no avoiding it.
Yeah. We can crown you an official cloudy.
Yeah, I love every second of it. No, guys, I'm running out of time, but we'll make sure that your website's up on our website, and if people missed it, they can connect with you, and I think the idea is absolutely phenomenal.
Thank you, Michael Ray. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to talking to you in a year.
Take care. Take care, guys. Good night.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Keisha Burton with us. She's the author of Beautiful Girl. That's a novel about eating disorders. She was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. She attended creative writing programs at the University of West Florida in Pensacola. And she was once a columnist for the professional writing magazine, The Writer's Journal. She was also once a publicist for a company in Dallas, Texas, Breakthrough Promotions, where she arranged for authors to be interviewed on radio and television shows and do book signings. She's currently attending college to receive her bachelor's degree in English with an emphasis in writing. And let us say, Keisha, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. Did I pronounce your first name right?
Keisha, yes, you did.
Oh, good. We want to get off to a good start. Beautiful Girl, a novel about eating disorders. Is this something that you experienced on a personal level? Did you experience yourself?
Yes. I'm a recovering anorexic, and for me, the disorder started when I was roughly 14 years old, going through that lovely puberty stage and dealing with all the body images and things like that. I didn't have a great image of myself. I felt I had to be what it was that they portrayed on television, and in doing that, I began to pretty much starve myself and work out excessively, and it plummeted from there.
Now, by the way, when we're talking about eating disorders, anorexia and a few of the problems that people have, it's not necessarily the eating disorder in and of itself. It's that effect that it has on family, on friends, in your entire world. Because what happens with most of us, Keisha, is we think that we have to live up to somebody else's standards, which drives you even deeper into whatever the problem is.
Yes, and that's the trigger with that. Most people think anorexia or bulimia is all about food and it's all about eating, and it's really not about that at all. It's about it's something within that person that they feel that they have to, pretty much what you said, have to meet everybody else's standards. They have to be perfect. It's something in them that drives them to that. And part of being perfect and accepted is being what society portrays as perfect. And they see what society portrays as perfect on television, in magazines. And so they say, okay, if that's what society wants, that's what I have to be in order to be loved and accepted. So it's far beyond the food. It has, believe it or not, as weird as it sounds, it really doesn't have so much to do with the food.
True. You mentioned personal image. And I really think when it comes down to it, most people need to define what beautiful is. You know, as the author of Beautiful Girl, now the key is this. I've seen people who I think are absolutely beautiful, and to somebody else they may not be. And there's nothing that they're going to do for that somebody else that's going to cause them to see any kind of beauty in their eyes. So one of the major lessons I think should be taught to kids is that beauty is inside of you, and when you have it, somebody who really loves you and appreciates you, they're going to recognize it in you. Anybody who, if they don't like you, if they don't like themselves, Keisha, they're not going to recognize it. And I think that's a great lesson for a lot of kids, but it's too bad that most people go through an entire life and never learn it.
And yes, this is true. That's our whole problem in the nutshell with society, is that we have tried to put a definition on what beauty is, and we're living in a world that's diverse. We are all different, and we are all unique in our own ways. And to try to put a definition on beauty and try to box it and say this is what it is in a world where everyone is so diverse, and then if you don't meet that standard or don't see yourself in that definition of beauty, you try to meet it, then it makes it hard. We're all beautiful we should be beautiful to ourselves and to other people. There's going to be somebody out there who sees you as beautiful. There shouldn't be a definition, a set definition as to this is what beautiful is.
Keisha, there's an example that I've used time and time again on the air, and I think it would just be appropriate at this moment. Go ahead and ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead, ask me.
Are you good looking?
Funny you should ask that. Absolutely. And if you don't think so, somebody else will. See, I think that's really the key. If I had the ability, if I had five women standing in front of me right now, and I had the ability to walk behind each one and look through their eyes to see me, I would see five completely different Michael Rays. One or two of them would be gorgeous, and the other ones would be whatever. And the people that don't see me as quote-unquote good-looking or beautiful will never see me at that. So when we say that you're beautiful, if somebody doesn't believe it because they've been around people who don't think so, they're living their standards, and they're never going to be beautiful to those people. Go find somebody that you're pretty to.
Yes, go be around people who celebrate you as you are and who does not see that think that they have to change you or that you have to look a certain way.
Yeah.
You're all who you are, and you were made that way for a reason.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that the biggest problem that most people have is they don't want to hear that. You know, you'll go to somebody who just, they don't think that they're attractive at all, and you say, well, you're beautiful. Well, they don't believe you. There's where the problem is. And they don't see it in themselves, and it's just that one moment of that aha moment when you begin to realize that there is nobody prettier than you, or there's nobody more beautiful than you are, and the people who are around you, they're going to see it.
Yes, because a reason, unfortunately, that the majority of our young women today do not believe when they hear that they're beautiful and they don't accept it is because beauty, unfortunately, has a definition. We place the definition on it. It's been defined, and they're not meeting it, and so they don't feel that they are beautiful, and that's really sad. It really is sad.
Yeah, no question about it. And it's just that little bit of believing in yourself, which is so hard for so many of us to do, because you get bombarded with these messages, and these messages have their effect on you. It's like when we talk about, you know, beauty. I have seen Lady Gaga a couple of times, you know, doing whatever she does, and I think that's one of the most unattractive women that I've ever seen in my entire life. Now, somebody else is going to look at her and think she's an absolute knockout.
Yes,
so what do you do with that?
In fact, you have millions who are looking at her who are thinking she's an absolute knockout.
Yeah.
And that's a great example, because in the way that she dresses, I look at it and I think there's no way. But there are some people out there who think that it's just absolutely fabulous and that she's wonderful. And that's my point. And that's why it's to their own.
Yeah,
if
but
that's what beauty.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. If that's what beauty is to you, then that's what beauty is to you. Who am I to say that it's not?
That's the whole point. The people, they're going to be people that she's absolutely beautiful to. I felt like I looked inside of her. There was a certain something that I didn't like. And yes, she's got a great body, and yes, she's got all the things that cause somebody to be known as attractive. But I watched her interviewed at one time, and there was just something. Now, that's for me now, not for everybody else. there was something for me that said, that's a very unattractive woman. So what are you going to do with that? Am I wrong? Not for me. You hear it? But I may be wrong for somebody else who loves her.
Exactly. And again, it goes back to the point as to it. Beauty is different for each individual. What's beauty for you may not be beauty for somebody else. And so it's wrong to look at someone and say, okay, you're not attractive, period. It's better, and even just to keep to yourself, say, they're not attractive for me, but for somebody else, they are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if you don't like what you see in the mirror, then you're not going to draw people to you who are going to like what that is. You got to like what you see first. I can't give anything to you that I don't have. And if I don't have any kind of love in me, there's no way you're going to get it out of me, because it's not there. If I love me and I like me, I'm going to love and like you. That's just the way it is. It's what you have inside is what you're going to give or not be able to give to someone.
And yeah, and now we're at a point in society where we have to begin to spread that message, because we have a message out there now that says this is what beauty is. We have now got to get to the point where we take that back and take a step back and say, okay, who you are and where you are and how you look is fine. You should love yourself. And right now we're just not there yet. And to be quite honest, looking at the media and looking at television and looking at the magazines, I see glimmer of hopes in some magazines that come out that try to change the image that's been put out there, but I don't see as of yet a great deal of change in that. And it's sad, because you can see what it's doing to the young women out there. You can see the eating disorders developing, and it's like for the media, it's gone by them. They don't see it. They're still putting out the images. And I don't see it changing anytime soon.
It's called what makes money. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And the idea is what you see on the media, the gorgeous women or men that you see on the media, there's a problem with that. Those are not the people that you're going to meet, fall in love with, and take home. There's where the key is. And are these people the kind of people that you want to be with? I'll give you a great example. Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen is around a lot of women, and there's a lot of people who think he's totally attractive. That guy's got a problem. And does that make him attractive? If you look at Charlie Sheen, do you see an attractive man?
No, I see a very sad man, actually. He has a lot of issues going on.
Right. But see, I think that's really what the key is. Keisha, you look at somebody, you don't see the outside of course you do. But what really is coming out is the inside. And that's what's going to attract you or push you away.
Yes, I agree. And the sad thing is, the people that we do see on the beautiful women that you see on television and the beautiful women that you do see in the magazine actually aren't the beautiful women physically that they're portraying. The magazines are so altered to begin with that it's sad. And the television, the women you see on television, I don't think it's realized how much makeup and how much lighting and what they had to go through to get whatever figure it is that they had because of what they feel like they have to portray. It's, you see all the, when you look at a figure like that on television and in magazines, all you see is what's there. You don't see everything that went behind it. And what goes behind it is a lot of makeup and a lot of effort and a lot of work.
Sure. No, absolutely. No question about it. And I think realistically, coming through it all is you can't try to be beautiful. You just have to let the thoughts of not being beautiful go away. And it's a choice that you have to make.
Yes, we are very much a society that's focused on the outside.
Yeah.
And I think it's been like that for centuries. It's always been what's on the outside, and it's still there, and it's catching up with us greatly. But again, sadly, there's still no change in it. I entitled my book "Beautiful Girl" because it's the complete opposite of what the character in the book thinks she is. Of course, she doesn't think she's beautiful. She's dieting excessively, and she's hurting herself to grab this idea of what she thinks beauty is, when in all actuality, if she stopped, she would realize that she is indeed beautiful just the way she is.
If somebody would have caught you early on, you know, way back when all of this started, you know, with the anorexia and the rest of it, and sat down and talked to you in a way that you talk to people now, do you think your life would have changed? Do you think you would have avoided having to go through all of that to get to where you are?
If they had caught me before the onset of the disorder, yes. Had they spoken to me while I was in the disorder, no. Because once you're in it, as sad as it is, you're not listening to anyone. You're already there. You're in it. And whatever anyone else tells you, you can't hear it, because when you look in the mirror, you don't see what everybody else sees. And it's very difficult to explain that unless you've had the disorder, because people can't grasp that. They think, why can't she see how thin she is? Because when you're looking in the mirror, you see something totally different. You see what you consider fat. And so had somebody caught me before I had started, yes, there could have been a change. While I was in the process, no. It takes that person. It took me finally hitting the bottom and realizing it for myself. And unfortunately for some young girls, they never realize it. There are a lot of girls who die from this disorder every year, and because they never get to the point where they realize it themselves.
You know what you're going to be thankful for? And you can turn around, look at your life, and you can say, thank you for everything that happened to me, because look what it gave you to do. Look at the lives you get to touch now. We don't recognize it when we're in it, but if you could really take a look at it afterwards, it makes all the difference in the world. It was a reason, it was a purpose that you had to go through what you had to go through to get where you are.
Yes, looking back, I'm very grateful that I made it through it. Knowing what I know now, knowing how many don't make it, knowing how many women suffer through it pretty much for the rest of their lives to the point until they do eventually die, I'm very grateful to be where I am, and I'm very grateful to be in a position where I can hopefully help someone else who's going through the same thing, even though they may not hear me. Maybe the little voice, they can catch it.
Yeah. Keisha Burton, we're running out of time. I want to thank you so much for being here. Is there a website that we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes, the website is www.keishaburton.com. On that website is all the purchasing information. And I thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, Keisha, thank you so much for being here. Take care. Nice job. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Now the curtain falls.